It's like a cold, cold winter. Plenty of ice and snow. But we'll keep the love light in our hearts aglow. Looks like a long, long winter. Baby, what do we care? As long as we have this love of ours to share. It's gonna be cold outside, gonna be warm inside. So we'll cuddle up by a cozy fire, side by side. Looks like a cold, cold winter. Summer is far away.
Hello and welcome to episode 3.9, the January 24th, 2024, Frozen Pipes edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. January is my least favorite month of the year. With the conclusion of the holiday season, January offers little but the harsh realities of winter. This year's single-digit temperatures and 60-mile-per-hour winds have been enough to hold us prisoners inside our houses and freeze a few unfortunate pipes here and there. But there is always a glimmer of hope somewhere, if you look for it. The sun now sets well after 5 p.m., and the extra light is welcome, as will be the warming trend coming up in the next few days. Hopefully we'll get enough warmth to unfreeze those pipes, and Dunkirk Dave will not see his shadow on February 2nd. Keep your fingers crossed. Summer is far away. Until then, I love you more and more each day. 'Cause it looks like a cold, cold winter. If you need a little heat in your life right about now, it's a good time to catch the upcoming Live at the Met production of Carmen on Saturday, January 27th at 1 p.m. Perhaps the world's most recognized opera title, Carmen brings the heat with both its story of love and passion and a musical score brimming with sensuality. I reached out once again to Tim Kennedy of Buffalo Opera Unlimited to give us his take on this famous opera. Well, coming to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, January 27th at 1 p.m. is one of the most popular and well-recognized operas in the whole canon, and that is Carmen by Georges Bizet. And with me to discuss this iconic opera is Mr. Tim Kennedy. Tim is the Artistic Director Emeritus of Buffalo Opera Unlimited. In fact, he is its founder and spent 35 years at the helm developing it. Tim, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Good to be here again. Yeah.
Is it your second visit? I'm glad to get you so many times now. This is wonderful. Maybe you'll have a second career here. We'll partner together for the operas.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay.
You need time to prepare. Yeah.
I'll always, Tim, always. So I really wanted to get you specifically, Tim, for this particular production and broadcast because I remember in our various discussions, you know, as we worked together, that you mentioned to me once that Carmen was your favorite opera, and it happens to be one of my favorites as well. Yes. And so I figured your insight is going to be terrific. And I also know that the final opera you staged for Buffalo Opera Unlimited was a production of Carmen. So I couldn't ask for anybody better in terms of this. So let me ask you right away, just from your own perspective, what is it about Carmen that makes it your favorite opera and so many other people's favorite opera?
Well, I think the most important thing that I think what makes it a masterpiece is, if you think about it, there's something exciting happening and amazing happening musically and dramatically in almost every scene. When I think about it, and of course, the music is incredible. But I mean, when you think about the fight in one scene and then the next scene, the Toreador song, just every scene, the card scene, the mountain scene, there's something thrilling and exciting and musically going on in every scene. And you don't get that in a lot, many operas. And not only is it something exciting going on to keep your interest, if it's directed well, of course helps. And not only do you not see that in every opera, but it's the music also. I mean, so it's everything all together. It's not just, you know, an adventure or something exciting. It's musically perfect almost, you know, in every scene. When you talk about the arias and the duets and the quintet, there's a quintet in Carmen that is a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. And it's just exciting all the way through. It just thrills you. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I found the same, I have the same response to it that you do, that it's probably the only opera that I can think of, like right off the top of my head, where I can literally say there's never a dull moment, you know. And I think you've listed them all. They're all so interesting and so exciting. Now, and the history of this opera is kind of interesting because, you know, when Bizet first had it produced, it was a scandal at the time.
Yeah. I mean, the French were not used to this. As a matter of fact, I understand, like at the first showing of it, you know, there was no applause at the end. Can you imagine Carmen with no applause at the end? I just think they were taken back, you know, cigarette smoking on the stage. That just was not in. You don't do such a thing. And, you know, at that particular time, that, you know, 19th century French people were just not used to that. Anything like that in opera. So they were appalled.
Yeah, they were. And it's amazing that that's the case. Bizet died shortly, I think, after this one was performed, like 3 months later. I don't know if he got to really enjoy this opera's ultimate success.
Yeah, well, that it's interesting you say that, because depending on who you read, it's been said that he died thinking Carmen was a failure. And that would have been, I mean, it makes for good press, but some people say that's not true. It was growing at that particular point. I forget now where he took it the second time after he left, you know, the Opera Paris. But that's when it really started getting favor and many people wanted to do it. And it was growing, but you're right. He died 3 months afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that he populated this opera with so many wonderful chorus numbers, because you need a good chorus. You need a children's chorus for this show. You need you need a great chorus for the Toreador en Garde number. The mountain scenes are just lush with that. Is that an unusual feature of an opera like that?
I think it is, because I mean, there's a very famous orchestral work called the Carmen Suite. And it's just the music, and it can be just exciting. Well, not as exciting, but almost exciting as the opera, because you hear all these popular tunes, you know, the Habanera and the Seguidilla, and as I said, that quintet, and that card scene is absolutely, it's that trio from the card scene. And the last act, I mean, I know people, believe it or not, who don't like Carmen, but they will tell you that last act is their favorite, you know.
Well, let's talk about the Met Opera production. You and I have been doing some digging into it, and I think the first thing that I really kind of set my eyes on, per se, and also my ears, because I saw some of the little clips, the video clips that they have there, is the young woman who's playing Carmen, Egil Akmenshina. She seems to be the focal point of this and seems to be doing a terrific job.
Oh, yeah. She's only 27 years old. And mm-hmm. she's already done it in several places in the country and out of the country. And she's from Russia, and she's very good. Very good. As a matter of fact, based on the reviews, she kind of stole the show. It was such a modern production. As a matter of fact, she's in cutoff jeans.
Yes, and cowboy boots.
And it's there's a gigantic truck on stage, and the Escamillo is a rodeo guy. It's very different, and it's very modern, like a lot of productions. It seems to be a concept that now is just not even extraordinary anymore. Especially with the old traditional operas, they're modernizing them. And sometimes they can be wacky, depending, on your view. And I'd be interested in finding out why they do that. Well, I mean, you've got loads of experience with that with Shakespeare in the Park, Tom. And of course, I don't know where you're coming from, but I just think it's a way of, dealing with the next generation. And it certainly can become a major debate.
Yes, I agree with you. You noted before, because this is a modern day Carmen, and the director is a woman by the name of Carrie Cracknell. And I think that she wanted to turn, she looked at this as, according to the notes on the website, with a feminist viewpoint. And one of the particular troubles of Carmen today in the 21st centuries, of course, is the violence against women aspect of this, because of course Carmen is murdered by the lover that she rejects, Don Jose. And so, it's problematic for 21st centuries audiences, and I'm not exactly sure how she solved that, because they're not giving it away on the website. But it is a point of view that I think for 21st century audiences is one that needs to be addressed.
Well, I can tell you, I was captivated by her concept, and I had to be very careful because she made the statement that she was tired of hearing this concept that it was a matter of passion between her lover and herself, but and the horribleness of it all. And she mentioned something about, we talk about domestic violence as things that we understood to be a secret between a man and a woman. And she's trying to frame it from a feminine side of view. And I had to be careful, how I approached this, especially when she made the accusation that men have always looked at it. It's just a passionate affair. And I don't look at it that way. I mean, I see it. This whole kind of stuff. She was saying basically, well, if you've got a woman who's unconventional, she does things different way, that's no reason to kill her, if the relationship doesn't work out. But I don't see Don Jose as that kind of person at all. It really jarred me when I listened to some of her concepts about, how she saw this horrible murder. And when you look at the opera, and basically the opera is very different from Mérimée, who wrote the piece in the beginning. And I think these two librettists try to ease the con, because basically in the original play by Mérimée, Carmen is married. There is no Escamillo. There is no Micaela in the play at all. But I think these two librettists that work with Bizet wanted to really add more to it, to give it more character that would play as an opera. And they added these two people, but it was very different. But as you said, in the 21st century, she wanted to really focus on this concept of, and of course it's still happening, two lovers or ex-lovers wanting to kill. Why would someone want to kill someone just because they're unconventional and they do things different ways? And I certainly can understand that, but I do not see that as happening in this Carmen. This is, I think I have some problems about the weaknesses of what they did with Don Jose myself in the beginning. I mean, he has no interest in gypsies. I mean, this is guy who's in the service, and they're kind of bored sitting around most of the time in Spain, And, you know, here comes the gypsies. Well, you know, he's from what? Andalusia, you know, and he likes Micaela. He has a relationship with her. He's a different type of personality than Escamillo completely. And to me, it's just a matter of, and she's having a good time. I don't know if she's having such a good time. And I think she says she's looking for love. And she doesn't have a center. And I agree with that, with Cracknell, when she says she doesn't have a center. But I don't think her life is miserable. I mean, she is, what she does is she works in a cigarette factory, and then she, you know, she works with a bunch of thieves who, you know, have contraband, who steal contraband. And I don't think she's even the leader there. I think she's part of it. The only, but I think Don Jose is a very naive guy that's in the country. I think he's attracted to her. That whole scene where she throws the rose in the beginning and he just, all of a sudden, he's in love, to me, it's just not, it's not strong enough. When I directed it, I thought of him, I talked to Don Jose as someone who I thought it was sexual. Mm-hmm. That this feeling that he had towards her, not so much that he was falling in love or the spell. And I know, of course, everything you hear about Carmen and the gypsies believing in superstition, especially the card scene, is a good example of it. She really believes that, you know, she's going to die after she plays cards in that third act. But basically, I think she's just has a life, and I think she's very independent. That's important to show. She doesn't care what you think. And she sings that in the Habanera, that first number, you know, love is like a bird. And I don't think she's looking for love at all. I think she doesn't believe in it. Mm. And anyway, I don't know what you feel about that, but I was captivated by her thought processes as far as Carmen as a character. And it was so different from mine. So I just wanted to speak on that. I do think, obviously, he fell in love with her, but this man gave up everything. I mean, right. he went AWOL. He went to prison for her, you know. And then by the third act, I mean, it opens and you see that there's argument right away. But she has that reputation. She never keeps a lover for more than 6 months.
Right.
And Escamilla knows that. And he's there just by having fun. And then he's a, but not, you can't do that to Jose. You know,
yeah.
He's not that type of character. He's made of different things. So I understand. I'll never understand murdering anybody, probably. But I mean, I could certainly understand what it did to him. And then, of course, he had to leave in the third act because his mom was dying. Mm-hmm. And when he comes back in the fourth act, he's a basket case. You know,
right, and all of that just piles up on him in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, the production itself, you know, it seems to be. I don't know what you're hearing. You're on a lot of opera blogs. I know you keep up with this kind of stuff, and I don't know what you're hearing. And although I think that the reviews seem to be a little bit tepid towards this particular production, I'm not sure audiences should miss it just simply because of that, because I think that the story and the music will still carry the day in a lot of different ways.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. I mean, you know, you might see what you consider a bad production of Carmen if you've seen a lot of them. But believe me, I mean, there's nothing you can do when you hear that music and you hear all of these arias and duets and quintets. I mean, it still brings back Carmen, and it's always, it's going to be here always. You know, I don't care what they do with it on stage. It's always going to be here because people love it.
Well, Tim, as always, thank you so much for your insight onto this production.
This was fun.
Yes, it always is, and I know it's gonna. I'm like doubly interested now to go see this production and see how it comes out.
I'm looking forward to it.
So we'll see what happens. All right, Tim, thank you very much, and don't get too snowed in up there. Okay.
Okay, we're doing. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Okay.
Take care now.
Take care, Tim. The Live at the Met's production of Carmen will be screened at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, January 24th at 1 p.m. Tickets are $20 for adults, $18 for members, and $10 for students. Call the box office at 716-679-1891 or go online at www.fredopera.org/tickets to get your tickets for this performance. Live at the Met is underwritten with support from Daniel S. Kaufman and Timothy W. Beaver. The SUNY Fredonia School of Music is gearing up for another prolific semester of musical performances. Their schedule is always chock full of concerts and master classes, and so I decided to catch up with the School of Music's assistant director in charge of admissions, Mr. Barry Kilpatrick, who is retiring at the end of this semester after 44 years of service to the School of Music. We talked about some of this semester's offerings. I am very, very pleased to have with me now to discuss the upcoming season at the School of Music, Mr. Barry Kilpatrick. Barry is the assistant director at the School of Music. He's pretty much in charge of admissions over there, and he has been in charge of the brass section of the School of Music, the brass faculty, and he is celebrating his 44th and final year as a member of the faculty at the School of Music. So congratulations, Barry, on your upcoming retirement.
Thank you very much. I'm amazed.
Well, let me reminisce with you about a little bit, because you and I used to work together doing admissions for the Department of Theater and Dance and you for the School of Music. 44 years. I hate to put it this way, but let's see if we can get an over. What do you think has been perhaps the most significant change over those 44 years that you have seen from the time you started in 1979 until now?
Well, I think the School of Music has improved a lot in that time. I think the student quality has improved greatly. The faculty is fantastic. In fact, I've often thought that, oh man, if I had to apply for a job here now, I don't think I'd stand much of a chance. So, so it's pretty fantastic what has happened quality-wise. Back when I started, when I started as a faculty member, that was 1979, we were about half our size now. And then when I got going on the music admission stuff in 1993, things really just started cooking. And so I guess, the overall quality is what I would say has really changed.
The overall quality. And you've also seen, believe when you started in 1979, only the original Mason was standing. You've seen some additions being built to the building and improvements and growth in that area too, yes?
That is true, yeah. Well, the new Mason, the part we call new Mason, where all the practice rooms are, that was on the building then. Mm-hmm. But right, the Rausch Recital Hall and the two fantastic rehearsal rooms between us and Rockefeller Arts Center, it was amazing. And those were built in 2008 at the height of the economic downturn, or should I say the low of the economic downturn. And we just couldn't quite believe it. And it happened. Mm-hmm. And then there's a connector, this simple little hallway between our two buildings, which no one other than alumni before that hallway can truly appreciate. To be able to walk from one building to the other in winter, like right now, without getting snowy and snowed upon, is incredible.
Yes. 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 I have recollections of making that a journey many times, and also, talking to musicians about, just going that short distance with their instrument, in their hand was risky. So
the percussionist had to rent a truck.
Yes.
Load it up in the Mason Hall loading dock and drive about 100 feet over to Rockefeller Arts Center and unload it. So It's really an amazing thing. And the day that hallway opened up, I walked through with my camera and took a little video of just walking through, just me. And then I posted it on Facebook, and all these music alumni were going, "What?"
So I'll ask you one more question, and then we'll get on to talking about some of the events coming up. And is there one single memory that you have that you say, okay, when I think of my career, this is the one thing I can think of that really stands out above everything else?
Well, probably the things that have happened the last with me about the last 8 years, 8 or 9 years, involving international students, really was a big surprise. Kind of came out of nowhere. I became friends with a Chinese student or two and started helping them with some of their graduate classes. And then the opportunity to go to China rose, and I took it. And then after that, went to China four times, China and Korea four times. And some of it was just learning. Some of it was recruiting. And Father Sean Duggan, our piano faculty member, went with me on two of those, and we ended up with about 40 students from China and Korea, which was almost 10% of the School of Music at that time. And then, of course, COVID happened, and things started dwindling a little. So we don't have quite that number today, but it has made for just a fascinating thing. I still meet with these international students mostly once a week, sometimes not every time, just to chat. And it's been great.
Yeah, I think that was a remarkable achievement. I remember all those trips you were taking and watching the students come in. It was really, really wonderful. Well, once again, my congratulations on 44 years. It is remarkable. And I hope you and Kathy enjoy your free time coming up. So let's talk a little bit about what's coming up in this School of Music. I'm trying to get a little bit of an overview so that, there's always a lot of events going on at the school. There's always, and I can always find at least one event, per week if I wanted to for the podcast, but let's see what we can get going on. And I've looked at the website and you have them, and we can touch upon some of the major events coming up. So the first two that I see are Serif Brass, which is a collection. You're a brass person, you're a trombone player, so that should be exciting to you.
I've heard recordings of theirs. They are very good. It's all female group.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I auditioned the trombone player way back when on Long Island.
Oh, there you go.
I accepted her, but I think she went someplace else.
Uh-huh. Well,
she's still making it in the world.
Obviously, and you can have a good laugh over that story too, I suppose, when they show up to perform. And I understand that there's something called Bach Together Again. It's going to be kind of a big event between current students, alumni, and current faculty.
Yeah, that's correct. There's going to be a guest artist on Baroque cello, and there are several returning alumni who are doing fantastically, and a whole list of current students. There'll be instrumental works, vocal works, etc. And that's on Friday, the 9th of February. Actually, February is just chock full of guest artists, etc. And once February is done, that's when our students start doing their recitals. So March, April, and into May, there's just so many student recitals and concerts. So any faculty members who want to get some extra good other kinds of concerts going, they need to do it in that first month.
right, so that they can have the students necessary to go. I know that for the Robert Jordan Piano Festival will be coming up, and you've got a couple of alums online for that.
And one of them is involved with the Steinway Corporation, and she's going to be demonstrating a new kind of a piano. I read the little blurb about it. It's the Spirio, high resolution player piano, which I just have to wait and see what the heck that is. But John Murphy will also be here for that weekend. He's a faculty member now at University of Oklahoma, I believe, and he was a great student, great pianist, piano student. So there's a lot of things happening this coming month with returning alumni. There's a trumpet player, Joe Gransden. There's the Choral Festival later in the month, February 23rd and 4th. Mm-hmm. We'll have a guest conductor from Furman University and all of our choirs, plus the Fredonia High School Choir. I was going to be singing in that.
Yes.
There's a wind conducting symposium. There's a bass fest at the end of the month with two guest artists. It's quite a month.
It's quite a month, and we haven't even begun to talk about the Western New York Chamber Orchestra.
That's true.
You've played with them.
I did. I played with them for a long time. I just stopped playing at one point, though, when it became just too difficult just to make a steady pitch.
Uh-huh.
And so, I played in the Erie Philharmonic for 20 years, with the chamber players. They used to call them the chamber players.
Right.
And the chamber orchestra for many, many years.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're going to be playing yet. I'm not sure their program is up yet, but they're playing two concerts this semester, which is kind of unusual. Usually they play one, but they're playing two.
Yeah, we're just getting into our audition season now too. We have an audition day a week from tomorrow
for uh-huh. the
day, and then four other days coming up after that, and we'll be hearing hundreds of people.
Well, tell me a little bit about the auditions. Like, if someone, if there's a young high school student who's interested in coming to study music at Fredonia, what is it that they have to go through in order to be able to audition for you?
Well, they apply to the university, first of all, and they'll indicate that they want a music degree program. And in the process of doing that, they will see that they need to audition. They'll see there's a link that they need to click on. They know how to do that. And it's an audition application site. And once they enter what they're interested in, they're an undergraduate. They want to major in, say, music education. And they are a trombone player. That as soon as they enter that information, up pops the trombone audition requirements. And then they start filling out this form. It's a slick way for us to get letters of recommendation. They just enter a teacher's name and their email address. And as soon as they submit the application, those teachers are notified. And it's all very, very slick, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
And they can choose a date, or they can send recorded videos.
They can do videos now.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people who are doing that, people from far away and not so far away even. And when they do that, then if we evaluate the video in a favorable way, then we get in touch with them via Zoom and chat with them and make them do what we call the oral skills test, which is a matter of matching pitch and sight singing, sight reading, and things like that. So that's an important part of the audition.
Yeah, and I assume that for students coming in here to study music at the School of Music, more difficult, less difficult, or do you find that your requirements lean towards a good class of student?
Well, we're a pretty flexible place, so we get some really high end students, some really fantastic performers, and we get some others who are more of a work in progress. And and actually, we enjoy working with those because they tend to show a lot of improvement, which is always exciting for everyone. And so, so there's no fixed standard. We want to see that somebody seems like we can work with them and that they're receptive to things and that they're willing to work.
I always found that to be the key. I would always, whenever I would audition a student, I would take a look at their work. I think that the thing that can we work with this person? Will they take coaching? Will they take direction? I think that's a really important element for students to understand, that it's not just necessarily your talent per se, but how much you're willing to put in the work to improve what you have. Yeah. And I think Fredonia does a really good job with that.
I think talent is a very misunderstood word. Too easily used.
Well, you know, someone with 44 years of teaching experience would probably know that. Tell me about one more event, because I'm very interested in this particular event, to tell you the truth. And the man who started the music composition program and was involved with a lot of composition work and headed the composition area for many years, Don Bolden, is turning 90 years old, and the School of Music is going to celebrate his work. Give us a little preview about what that's going to entail.
Well, I know that it's happening, and I just, you know, in response to your invitation to me to join you today, I looked at the various events, and I did look at the blurb that's on the School of Music website about this 90th birthday celebration for Donald Bolan. And I didn't take notes exactly to record exactly what will be played, but there will be at least a piano piece. There's a trio piece. There's just some variety. Music faculty members, I know there's one guest artist coming in, at least one. So I'm sure that's going to be a very meaningful event.
Yeah, I think so, because I think he's had a terrific influence, not only on composition students that have come through, but also other music students and younger faculty, for that matter. Yeah. You know, I know, I remember talking to, I call them young now, but considering that, you know, Dr. Bolan started in 1974, and I got to know him ever so slightly before he retired. He had an influence in the School of Music in terms of faculty looking up to him, the way he taught, the way he went about his business. Quite an intriguing gentleman with a wealth of musical knowledge.
And he's still around. He's still in the community.
And he's still in the community. I know. I think that's great. I think listening to what he's going to play and some of his works, I think is going to make a real nice evening over at the School of Music. We also have a couple of other events just to touch on them. There's Harp Day coming up, 2 days of harp on with a grand finale of, I don't know, half a dozen harps on the Rausch Recital Hall stage. At least, right? Probably more.
Probably more. Wow. Yeah, you know, harp is really an incredible instrument. I mean, anybody just looking at it would have to agree. Just visually, it's incredible. And then there's the sound, and then there's the technique it takes to play it. And every orchestra concert has important harp parts, and there's not all that many people playing the instrument these days. Mm-hmm. Just like piano, I mean, you know, there are other things that are occupying people's time. So this Harp Day is we hope a way of getting harpists here on our campus into this building, and we hope, of course, that some of them eventually will audition for us.
Yes, that would be really terrific. And of course, finally, the year ends up with Masterworks, as it always does. I'm not exactly sure what the program is for that yet, because that's not on the website. But the Masterworks program has been going on for quite some time. Is usually a very, very significant event with a large and quite well known a musical event. Right. Shall we say
collaboration with orchestra and choirs, and it should be fantastic. I also don't know what they're doing.
Well,
I doubt eventually
it'll come out when when it does, we'll make sure we'll get it on the podcast. Barry, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. Again, congratulations on your retirement. I think it's a wonderful career that you've had, and I know that you've enjoyed it. And we have, of course. You know, I've always enjoyed knowing you and working with you. It's always been a pleasure, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Same to you, Tom. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, you're welcome. Good luck.
Thank you.
If you would like to get a complete look at all the arts events coming up at SUNY Fredonia, you can click on the link in the show notes webpage that will take you to all the arts events coming up, including offerings from the Department of Theater and Dance and Visual Arts and New Media. For now, here's the arts calendar for the next 2 weeks in the region. The cinema series at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House has two films coming up. The first is Immediate Family, a documentary exploring the contributions of four famous session musicians of the 1970s who played with such musical giants as Carole King, James Taylor, Stevie Nicks, David Crosby, and many others. Immediate Family screens on Saturday, January 27th, and again on Tuesday at January 30th at 7:30 p.m. It's followed by George Clooney's film, The Boys in the Boat, a biographical sports drama that tells the story of the University of Washington rowing team that won the gold medal in the 1936 Olympics. Screening dates are Saturday, February 3rd and Tuesday, February 6th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets for both these movies are available at the door only, and now you can get a book of 10 movie passes for only $60 at the door. The Kathy and Jesse Marion Art Gallery has opened its exhibit, Is Anything the Matter? The Drawings of Leila Ali. The exhibit runs for the spring semester. The Marion Art Gallery is open Tuesday through Sunday. See their website for specific hours. And finally, the Rockefeller Art Center's Kaleidoscope series presents The Boy Who Cried Wolf, performed by the Tutti Frutti Theatre Company of England, on Saturday, February 3rd at 2 p.m. Tickets for this family-friendly show are $16 for adults, $12 for students, and can be purchased by calling the campus box office at 716-672-3501 or online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. One of the things I wish I would do more often, and perhaps I should make a New Year's resolution out of this, is covering local artists working in the region. This week I had just that opportunity, as local photographer Tom Janik has an exhibit of his photography now on display at the Darwin R. Barker Library in Fredonia. I managed to get this interview with Tom just in the nick of time for this episode to talk about his exhibit and work as a photographer in the region. I'm really, really very, very happy to be joined right now by Mr. Thomas Janik. Tom is a professor emeritus of chemistry at SUNY Fredonia. But the reason that I have him here is because he's one of the most interesting artists in the region. He's a photographer. He's taken numerous amounts of photos of the area. And he currently has an exhibit called Scenes from Where You Live. It is being exhibited at the Darwin R. Barker Library, downtown Fredonia, and it's up now until the end of February. So welcome, Tom.
Oh, well, thank you, Tom, and I'm flattered you invited me for this.
I want to just say right off the top of my head that you know, I've actually been thinking about trying to get you on this podcast for some time, because between you and Tom Anir and Patrick Stokes, you guys produce some amazing work, and I've never really had an opportunity to get any one of you on the podcast. I know your work comes, I've done the art trail previews before, but I've never really been able to focus on you guys as local artists, and I've always wanted to do that. So to me, this is a real pleasure to get someone who is working locally, because I understand that all the photographs that you have in this exhibit are taken 10 miles within a 10 mile circumference of the library.
That's true. So as you mentioned, I've been a member of the Art Trail for a long time. And of course I have photographs from other places. A lot of my photographs are local, of course, because that's where I am, particularly when I was working. But I discovered through the Art Trail that local pictures are much more likely to resonate with the viewer that you get here. And that makes sense. They live here. They like seeing perhaps a scene that they hadn't recognized or in a different light, or perhaps a shot that reveals some of the spectacular beauty that this area has that they hadn't noticed before. And I learned that both in the Art Trail, and I had a great venue for my photographs in the Brick Room. I had photographs up there for several years, And I would get comments from people of the type that would be thanking me for showing them how beautiful it is here, because like Buffalo that we talked about earlier, there is this sense that, at least for some people, that this is not a spectacular place to live or a particularly beautiful place to live. They might occasionally say, oh, that, you know, that's lovely out there, but they don't think of it as beautiful as somewhere exotic where you have to travel to. So that's been a very rewarding aspect. And that's why I set this show up with the title that it has. I want people to know, you know, that all of these are practically within walking distance of where they're standing at that moment.
Yeah. And language fascinates me, and it's always interesting to see, you know, just the difference that a pronoun makes. And you didn't entitle it "Scenes from Where I Live." You entitled it "Scenes from Where You Live." And I think that that's a very significant thing to do, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's directed at the audience. And, you know, as I mentioned, I have some great pictures from, you know, Yellowstone, Yosemite, various other locations. And I like them, but I in terms of appeal to the audience, I think local scenes are much more important.
So let me just ask you about your interest in photography, how you got to it. I know you say you didn't have any training, but you know, just looking at your photos and looking at the way you compose them and the how you use light, one would be hard pressed not to think had some training. It's because they're really quite spectacular.
Well, thank you, Tom. But I've had no formal training. That doesn't mean I haven't had some self training. I actually have at least one of the first photographs I ever took. I must have been about 9 or 10 years old. We lived in Southern California then, and we were visiting my uncle in San Diego, and it was a picture of an aircraft carrier. And what I notice in that photo now, in hindsight, after, you know, reading tons of photography books, is I had arranged that photo with a diagonal going through it, which was the shoreline, which led to the subject, the aircraft carrier, which is sort of a classic way of composing a photo. But, you know, I just did it. So I think there's something in my brain that makes me see things through a camera and see it as a composition. I may be aggrandizing this photo a little bit, but it's something that has struck me. Anyways, so I used that camera for some time until one day we were in the desert, and I left it on the shelf behind the rear seat in a sedan. Now, it was bright sun. I don't know what the temperature was, maybe 110. When we came out of the restaurant, the camera had melted, not into a pool, but it was so deformed that it was basically unusable. And that was the end of the first stage in photography. It wasn't until I got to college that I took it up seriously again.
And how, you know, one of the things that always fascinates me about photography and photographers, especially the kinds of work that you do, landscapes and nature and so on. How do you photographers get to be in just the right place at just the right time? it's either an amazing amount of patience or luck, because it's like you see that sunset, for example, it's like it's just at the right time. You manage to get those. I saw pictures of two little owls, and you know, and you manage to get them with just the right expression. You know, how do you guys do that?
Well, you know, there are a lot that you miss. And you don't see those because there's no photograph. So some of it is luck. Some of it is anticipation. and planning and going out when you don't really want to go out. And I'll give you two examples. There is one photo up in Barker Library called Fire and Ice. And I'll describe it to you. It was taken in the spring. The lake had been frozen, had thawed. So there were big chunks of ice along the shore, basically floating in the water. And we were having the kind of weather where it would go above freezing during the day, there would be some melting, but then it would freeze again at night. So these chunks of water were locked in place. And I had gone, this was down at Point Gratchett, and one night I noticed that just as the sun set, the direct sunlight would hit the ice that was protruding out of the water, but not be hitting the water at all anymore. So it led to a kind of a spectacular effect where the ice looked like it was, a light bulb. And so I went back and back and back until I got a photo that I was happy with at that instant, just as the sun reaches the horizon, illuminating the protruding ice. So that's something that just, first you had to recognize it, then you had to do the work to get the photo. There's another photo up at the exhibit that's sort of the complete opposite. And it's a photo that I really like. And I've sold quite a few copies of it. It's called No Wind Today. And it's a perfectly still photo of Lake Erie, but it's near sunset and the light is golden. But there's a little bit of blue left in the sky. So in terms of the color palette and arrangement, I find it really, really pleasing. So it's a very calm scene of the lake. There's no shoreline, but there is a line of very small Canada geese out in the water. So I find that photo very calming. And the reason I have it is several years ago, I gave myself a self-assigned task. I wanted to take a picture and print it every day for a year. And sometimes that was easy. I had an idea, I want to take this picture. A lot of times it was, oh my God, it's late. I haven't taken a picture yet. What am I going to do? So this one, I had come home from Fredonia. I was tired, wanted to make dinner. I didn't want to go out and take pictures, but I live fairly close to the lake. So I said, okay, I'm just going to go down. I'm going to take a picture of the lake. That'll satisfy the requirement of taking a picture. And I went down there and that picture presented itself and it ended up being one of my favorites. So that was strictly accidental in the sense that I just went there because it was close. Mm-hmm. But it's also kind of intentional in a way because I've given myself that assignment. So it's a variety of things.
Yeah, but I always have found it fascinating. I was scanning your Facebook page, which has a number of your photos, and you have this one photo that appears to be, first there's one tree in a golden light. And then all of a sudden, there's two trees in that same golden light, and that's
And that was in the Finger Lakes. I'm glad you like that because I love that photo. It's not one of my most appreciated, we were on our way to Ithaca, and that was a slope facing north, more or less. And the sun was coming down and hitting those. Most of the trees on the slope had lost their leaves, other than that one or those two, and they were being illuminated by the sun, but the ground was not, and they just seemed to pop out. I'm glad you enjoyed that.
I did. I enjoyed it immensely. I just thought it was so interesting to me to see first one and then the other. It's just like, wow, yeah. That's really great. As you mentioned, you've been out to the West a lot and you've taken a lot of pictures in the American West and in many of the wonderful natural places we have, such as Yellowstone and Teton and a lot of those areas like that. What do you find the essential difference between taking pictures of these, you know, the grand scale of nature of the American West, as opposed to the, you know, the more subtle landscape that we have here in Western New York?
Well, subtle is a key word there. You know, the West is spectacular. And nonetheless, okay, if let's say you go to Yosemite, that's got to be one of the most photographed places on Earth. Unless you've got the right light or a good sky, by that I mean clouds and light, it'll be a spectacular photo. Well, it's a photo of a spectacular valley. It may not be a spectacular photo, if you understand what I mean by that distinction. You know, the landscape is spectacular, and that can carry a photograph. But for a photograph to be spectacular, there has to be something else to it. So what we do have here that is less common in the West are absolutely spectacular skies. And if you look at the photos that I have up at the Barker, and also I printed a book called Cooler by the Lake, which is supposed to be a pun on weathermen who say it's, you know, they always say it's cooler by the lake, but living here, it's also cooler to be by the lake. So there are a lot of them are lake-based, and the reason they work is because of the skies. The skies here are just phenomenal. I like to tell people that the lake puts on a light show every night. And to a certain extent, it does. I've looked out my window and thought that there's a spectacular sunset going on. But I've got to dice this onion. I'm not going to go out because there'll be another one tomorrow. And that's almost always true.
Is there any place that you would really like to go and photograph that you haven't been to yet?
Oh, gosh, that's almost anywhere that I haven't been. Actually, there is a place we planned on going to in March of 2020. And just to remind you, that's when COVID really hit the fan. We had a camper rented in Scotland and we were going to go to the Isle of Skye. So that's a place I've never been to and I would really like to go. But I think one thing that photography has taught me, and you're asking about comparing taking pictures here to the West, but you could make that more global. I think every place has its own beauty or even spectacular views. It's just in some cases it's much more subtle, and so you have to seek it out, look for it. Recognize it. To answer your question directly, Scotland.
Okay. I can't blame you for that. Listen, Tom, I wish I could talk to you for a much longer time, but I really appreciated the time that you've given me for this particular interview. And I certainly hope that people listening will tell their friends and themselves go out to see your photographs, because I know I've seen them up in the Brick Room when I used to go to dinner there, and numerous other places, and they're always spectacular to look at. And what you have done with the photographs for me personally, as well as I'm sure for other people, is made us understand how beautiful the place we live really is. I mean, I think it's a beautiful place to live, which is why I'm still here. But every time I see one of your photographs, it reminds me, you know, yes, this is a spectacularly beautiful region that we live in.
Well, thank you, Tom. And I'm glad you've enjoyed them. I wish the Brick Room were still there, but
so do I.
for two reasons. I like to eat there too.
That's right. All right, listen, Tom, you have yourself a good day today, and I appreciate it, and hopefully people will get out to see your photos. Thanks once again.
Yep. Bye, Tom.
Scenes from Where You Live, featuring Tom Janik's photography, is now on exhibit at the Darwin R. Barker Library. Admission is free. please see the Darwin Barker Library webpage for information on open hours. The exhibit runs until the end of February. And that's it for this Frozen Pipes edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Tim Kennedy, Barry Kilpatrick, and Tom Janik for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking on the follow button on our homepage at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's notice, if possible, to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, February 7th, 2024. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there, and be kind to one another.